Is titled Architecting Private Clouds Using Server 2012. And I think that's probably not quite the right title for what we'll cover today. I think maybe it should be called Architecting Windows Server 2012 for Private Clouds. My name is Michael Pascoe. I'm the Managing Director from a systems integrator called Olica. We're a specialist systems integrator. We're a Gold Microsoft partner in management and virtualization, desktop, silver, and server. We specialize in infrastructure management and virtualization. And we focus really just on two areas only, private cloud and Windows client. And today we're talking about, obviously, private cloud. So what is the session today about? It is about that lower level infrastructure of your private cloud using Server 2012. So we'll be looking at how Server 2012 can be designed, architected and built to be that cloud infrastructure. Okay? We'll work through some of the considerations that you need to think about when you're designing that low-level infrastructure. We'll think about what kinds of workloads you're running on it. We'll look at some of the new networking technologies, I guess, and what's been built into Server 2012 for supporting private cloud infrastructure with networking. We'll see some of the storage options that you have. And we'll also kind of consider the resiliency that you need to build as well. Now, people were asking me before the session a little, is this about like Hyper-V? It's called Server 2012, but is it really just Hyper-V? And I think the answer is, look, yeah, it's a lot about Hyper-V. I mean, Hyper-V is Microsoft's infrastructure-based platform for private cloud, but a lot of the features that we'll talk about that enable Hyper-V to do some pretty awesome stuff for private cloud are actually just really built into Server 2012. So it's not about Hyper-V alone, but it certainly, in this session, is about that server platform rather than the management stack through System Center. And of course, you need both for private cloud. You need that great virtualization platform and you need to manage it really well. And I'm actually doing another session this afternoon at 5 o'clock, which is all about that management layer on top of the virtualization layer. And in that one, we'll look at some of the features and capabilities in System Center and compare them to what VMware are offering in that space. And the last thing we'll look at today, this morning in this session, is we'll have spoken through some of the things you need to consider: workload, networking, storage, resiliency. But to make it real, because you kind of talk about these things, we'll look at a few example scenarios and the designs that you might put in place for each of those scenarios, and we'll use that to kind of draw out some of the features that do work together or don't work together and why you might consider using some or not and what advantages or benefits you might get out of them. So when Microsoft set about designing Server 2012, they knew that it had to be a cloud OS. It had to be designed to be the infrastructure for cloud. And for Microsoft, cloud really meant or means, as far as server is concerned, three things, right? It has to be multi-tenant capable. It has to be able to scale to very big and drive that cost right down. And, of course, because it might be really big, and to drive the cost down, it needs to be manageable, automatable, extensible. Microsoft couldn't possibly create a platform here that suited every single person's every need. So they've focused, like they do, in making the platform extendable so that ISVs or even yourself can kind of add into that what you need. So when it comes to multi-tenancy, and in fact all of these features, when they set this kind of vision of what they needed, they then created a long list of features that were needed to actually produce that kind of capability. And multi-tenancy, things like network virtualization, quality of service at the host and the guest, being able to live migrate storage and workloads, being able to connect up to other people's or clouds on different premises. They were all really needed for multi-tenancy. And when it comes to management, you know, everything in Server 2012 for your private cloud infrastructure can be automated through PowerShell. And so this is really important and really key to actually making it a cloud platform rather than just a new good server platform. Because if you don't have that automation, then you can't really let all of the orchestration tools and the self-service and all of that kind of work, because you need someone in there doing things manually. So it really needs to be automatable. And this enables things like System Center to do such a great job on that stack on top. So high scale and low cost. When we look in this area, there's really three sub-areas, I guess. Compute, networking, and storage. So in the compute front, there's been a lot of focus by Microsoft on making Hyper-V scale big. Right, we've heard before in the keynotes, you've probably heard in some other sessions today already, larger hosts, larger VMs, more VMs, higher density. It really can scale big. And not just big, but cheaply, driving that cost down. So things like all of the network processing offloading that is available. Server 2012 has taken advantage of lots of the protocols that are available and the standards for hardware offloading of processing, network processing tasks, which frees up the CPUs to actually be used for workloads, right? The point of running this, to run the workloads. And so these are things that actually make it low cost and scalable. And on the storage side, there's also been a lot of innovation and changes in your storage options. So we'll look through some of those as we go through, and we'll see things like the ability to store over SMB and, you know, things like the offloading to the SAN, storage spaces, thin provisioning, all these new options and technologies that have either been created by Microsoft or adopted by Microsoft in Hyper-V allow us to think differently when it comes to designing the storage. We don't necessarily have to stick to the way that we've been doing storage with virtualization up till now. Now, to kind of set the context, this is the data center reference architecture. And really, if you think about this, it's like everything you need to do private cloud properly, right? And this session is just focused there in those red bit, the hypervisor layer and the compute, the networking and the storage for that. I'm glad I'm not doing all of it today. Okay, so that's cool. We understand we want to build this infrastructure and with Server 2012. Where do you get started? Like, there's just so many things to consider. There's organizational factors. I've got existing investments. It's hard to change my network topology. And then, you know, that's just thinking about what I've definitely got today. What about the requirements that I might need to provide? You start thinking about high availability and reliability and, you know, how much do I need this to scale? What kind of performance do I need out of it? Security factors and obviously the cost, right? And as you start to think about these things even more and more, it kind of, you end up in really four categories that you need to make decisions on. And that you need to understand things about. So workloads. You need to know what the workloads are that you're going to run on your private cloud. I mean, you know, the whole point of having private cloud is to run some kind of service, some kind of workload on top. What is it? Do you know what it is? Do you know what it needs? So you need to understand that. Oh, networking. Hey, I can probably go to this slide, it's the same thing. Networking. You know, that infrastructure, the fabric below, what you've got now or what you want to change it to, will that support those workloads requirements? Storage, I was saying before, there's lots of new options available. There's also lots of opinions out there on what storage should be like and how it should be. So there's a lot of non-technical factors to kind of consider in that mix there as well. And then lastly, resiliency, you know, just understanding what your approach to resiliency is. How much resilience do you actually need to build into the platform? So they're the four areas that you really need to consider when you're thinking through your design options for private cloud infrastructure. And we'll work through each one, right? So workloads. In here, there's really three kind of big questions about those workloads. Is the workload itself cloud aware? So does it need the infrastructure layer to provide a good resilient kind of system, or is it actually aware that maybe I can't rely on that layer and I'll provide that within the app? So has it been written for that? You know, things like Azure, then Azure can make certain assumptions that the applications need to provide some kind of resiliency within the application layers, within those service tiers. But in enterprise IT, we don't probably have that luxury, right? Like, there's a lot of applications and workloads out there that aren't clusters. Like, the VMs themselves aren't clustered. And so if you do need to provide resiliency and high availability of those workloads, then the infrastructure needs to provide it. So you need to know whether you need to provide that or not. Let's face it, probably the answer is yes, mostly here. So even though you know that it needs to be highly available or that the app itself doesn't provide the resiliency, what else do you need to know about the workload? Do you know how disk intensive it is? What kind of network usage it needs? Compute power? So you just need to profile those workloads and understand. You might have a mix, and that's okay, and I think most people do, but it's worth consideration, right? And lastly, what level of trust exists between the workloads that are going to be running on there? And I don't just mean, you know, are you a hosting provider and you're running workloads for two different companies and they need to be completely network isolated, but even if you're running internally, do you trust that one workload won't go and steal all the resources at a particular time and then degrade the quality of service from another workload? So considering that mix of workloads together, and can they be trusted or not, or do you need to put some kind of quality of service around them to guarantee that they don't steal resources from the other workloads that are running on the shared infrastructure? Okay, so you think about your workloads, and then you start to think about your networking. In networking, there's really, again, three main areas that you need to kind of delve into. One is, what kind of isolation of traffic flows do I need? What kind of infrastructure do I need to provide underneath? What fabric, gigabit Ethernet, 10 gigabit Ethernet or InfiniBand, those kinds of things? And then also, what kind of hardware offloading, the NIC offloading technologies are important to me? Maybe you've got to consider what hardware you have and therefore what technologies that supports and what you can use from that. Or maybe you need to consider what you want and which in turn will drive what you have to go and buy, what hardware you'll purchase. Because not all the hardware comes with all the NIC offloading features. So when we think about that traffic flow, that first one, delving in now, you can really kind of start to look at the traffic flow in like this. You know, there's kind of these five basic types. To help you work through it, if you start to group them together and you think, well, the virtual machine traffic flow, this is your tenant network, right? The VMs themselves, this is the network that they're using to provide services to end users or other machines. So that's pretty clear cut. That's by itself. And then pretty much you can group all the others together and say, this is data center traffic. This is infrastructure management traffic. This is just traffic needed to provide the environment. And so if you group them up like this and just think of them separated as tenant traffic and data center traffic, they can really help you kind of move into the next question, which is, how many NICs should there be in a server? Because that's probably what you're wondering when you're designing your network. How many NICs am I going to have? So put your hand up if you're running some kind of infrastructure virtualization now. You've, you know, Machine virtualization, hypervisors, yep. Keep them up if you've got two network cards or more in that server, in all your servers. Two, keep them up. Keep them up if you've got three cards. Keep them, or more. Keep them up if you've got four or more. Five or more. Yeah, so four was very, very common. Five probably got like, you know, 20% of people or something. Six or more. We've got more sixes than fives. Sevens. Few. Eight. Nine. There's a nine over there. Any other nines? How many have you got?
Ten.
All right. So what we see is pretty typical is around that five mark. And really the five is what was best practice, or what is best practice for Server 2008 R2. One NIC or one network for every one of those traffic flows that we showed. And so you can do that. You can still do that. You have one network for every one of those traffic flows. And it's really easy to kind of map into your environment at the moment. You're thinking, that's what I've got, that's what we'll have, everyone understands it. But there are a couple other new options. So we can instead start to go, let's just think about two traffic flows, two types, that tenant traffic and the data center traffic. And now it doesn't need to be just two NICs. Some of those NICs might be teamed, so you still might have multiple network cards, but you're just thinking about it as one network connection, or two network connections in this case. And you can even go a little bit further and say, actually, I just have one network connection, might be multiple NICs teamed, but just one for tenant and data center management. And then, you know, what lets us do this is that there's features in 2012, like quality of service, both on the NIC and the VMs, hardware offloading of processing of that quality of service, and we can use these features to actually still provide isolation of those networks and guarantee performance of those networks. So you don't need to think that I have to physically separate them out to logically separate them out and still guarantee security and performance across them. So a few options here. Let's think about the layer down, the fabric. What will you be running? Gigabit Ethernet, obviously quite common at the moment. 10 gigabit Ethernet, we're seeing kind of like the pretty common new thing being put into enterprise data centers. People know how to manage it. It's pretty similar to gigabit Ethernet. You get it. It's pretty fast, 10 gigabit, but it is a bit expensive. It's quite costly for the hardware and even the cables to implement. So there's some other options around. InfiniBand, faster, but the downside is that it's a different way of managing it. You don't manage it the same as Ethernet, so you kind of got to commit to making that investment in understanding that and managing that differently. But if you do, you know, the actual hardware for it, the kit for it is cheaper. So it's cheaper and faster, but something different, something new, you might not have the skills. And then, of course, you've got your gigabit switched Ethernet at the moment, and you know, that's pretty good. You're pretty happy with it. It's working pretty well, and you can probably keep using that. Like, it might be adequate for many workloads with a single gigabit. And, of course, you can team them up. And so you can get two, three, four, five gig out of it. So this is, I think, also going to be a really, really common architecture for that fabric, just using what you've got and pulling it together. Maybe treating the network multiple cards as logically one big network connection and then using those other features we spoke about before to separate the traffic flow out. Right, now, let me have a drink first. This is, I think, where it starts to get to a few acronyms. So we spoke about the traffic flow. And we spoke about the fabric, and there was a third area that there's kind of major decisions to be made around networking, which is what offloading, hardware offloading technologies will you use? And so there's a few available and in the mix. So data center bridging, this is the hardware processing of your quality of service. So you still define quality of service policies in your OS, but the actual processing and enforcement of those QoS rules are offloaded onto the network card, which frees up CPU cycles for actual, you know, guest workload. RDMA is the protocol that really enhances SMB3. So it allows a server, a guest, to make a request to some data on the network via SMB, and using the right kind of hardware on the way through, it can improve the speed and decrease the amount of CPU cycles needed to get that data from the SMB share over the network, through the host, through into the guest and into memory in the guest, so that it can be read by the application. So it can kind of do that directly, which means that there's less CPU cycles needed on both the host and the guest virtual CPU to retrieve that data so it's available for use. So again, this is another protocol that actually enables high performance of storage over the network, but also, I guess, high scale because you're reducing the CPU usage of the host and guests. Now, RSC and RSS are both technologies. I think I should have been clicking through this, actually. RSC and RSS are both technologies to control or offload the processing of traffic flow control. So again, it's really about offloading some of that to the network card so that the CPU isn't used as much. And VMQ is kind of the same thing for the virtual machine networking as well. So normally when, packets come in for a virtual machine, they come into the NIC that's being used for those virtual machines, then something needs to process that and go, okay, well, which virtual machine is this traffic for? And without VMQ, it's typically just the single core. And so you can find that that single core gets pegged and becomes a bottleneck for network throughput just in deciding which virtual machine do I have to redirect this traffic to. So VMQ lets you spread that direction traffic across multiple cores on the host. So it's using the resources in the host more efficiently in order not to create a bottleneck. Okay, IPsec task offloading. So if you've got virtual machines running IPsec, or using IPsec, you can offload some of the processing of the actual IPsec encryption. So you can offload that onto the network card. So again, it's freeing up the CPU cycles in the guest and letting the network card do that work. And then lastly, the one on the list here is SRIOV, single root IO virtualization. And this is a technology that allows a virtual machine to get direct connection to the physical NIC. So sometimes you might want to architect this to get the highest kind of most raw performance from that network card straight into the network connection on the virtual machine guest. But just be aware here that when you do use SRIOV, you're bypassing that virtual switch. So any features that are needed, that are implemented using the virtual switch, you can't use. So it's not always compatible. And really that brings us to this kind of overarching question around choosing your NIC offloads. Sometimes you're kind of picking between raw performance and flexibility. So, you know, particularly RDMA and SRIOV aren't compatible with all of the other features. So as we work through some of the example scenario designs, I'll call out where maybe they're not compatible with each other. Okay, the third area of consideration is storage. So, look, this is an area where there's a few things to consider. The simple one is really the performance of the storage and the cost of the storage. That's kind of easy to calculate. You can measure that, you can get a calculator out, you can work it out. But it's a bit more complicated than that because there's other things to consider, like, you know, do you want your storage to be block-based or file-based? Does anyone know what I mean by that? Block-based or file-based? A few nods? Yeah? So really, kind of simply, like, you know, you're going to use a SAN or are you going to use a file server? I mean, if we break it down to that kind of real simple level, that's what we mean. So will we use, like, SMB3 and the new, you know, scale-out file server in 2012 to provide my storage? Or do I feel like I still need it block-based directly on a SAN? Some questions there. And part of the answers to that question include considering things like, well, how do I manage it? Where are my bottlenecks? Who manages storage? Is it a separate team? If it is, then how will, you know, what kind of input do they need to have into it? How will they manage it ongoing? And sometimes vendor preferences come into the mix here. In fact, often, you know, people have kind of either existing investments in particular vendors that they obviously need to extract value from, or they've got, you know, more strategic alliances with those vendors. So what does a vendor provide in the area? And then the last area is with storage to consider is, like, how am I going to scale my storage out? There's kind of two main approaches to it. You can scale it independently from your compute, right? Or you can scale it with your compute. So if we think about scaling it independently from compute, you've got Hyper-V servers, say, clustered. They're the compute nodes. And then you've got some storage. And you can add more compute nodes, and you don't necessarily add more storage because you might already have capacity or whatever. Or you can add more storage and you don't necessarily have to add more compute. And that's kind of what everyone's pretty used to now, right? Like, who fits that model with their virtualization hypervisors today? Yeah, actually a few less than I thought, probably only about half. So this will be interesting. I'd like to see where the others fit into. But the other and kind of new approach with 2012, still in this scaling them independently, is to have your Hyper-V server compute nodes and have storage nodes, but instead of necessarily just being SAN, it can be another server 2012 cluster, a file server cluster, and that's providing the storage for the Hyper-V servers for them to store the workloads on. Now, that 2012 file server might actually still be using a SAN behind it to hold the data, or it might be using something else, like some other kind of shared storage, maybe just a bunch of disks, SAS disks. It's still shared storage, though, and that's an important thing. It's still shared storage front-ended by a cluster of file servers. Actually, it doesn't need to be shared and it doesn't need to be a cluster, but I think in most environments, you know, you'll want it to be. On the other side of the option there is scaling them together. So in this kind of approach, there's one option here which you might not have thought about. Like, it's not always completely obvious, but you can create a Hyper-V cluster, right? So it's a cluster still. And that cluster still has connection to shared storage. It just happens to be that that shared storage is really kind of directly related to that cluster. So you add a new cluster node and you connect it up to that shared storage and you probably increase the capacity of the shared storage at the same time. And that shared storage, not a SAN, but maybe like SAS JBOD disks, right? And I guess the point here is, like, that storage for those Hyper-V servers is only used for those Hyper-V servers. It's attached to those Hyper-V servers and only used by them. But it is still shared storage so that it can operate in a cluster. That's one option there. And the other option, which is pretty obvious, is just a single node Hyper-V server with direct attached storage that isn't shared. So I was saying that option one might be quite popular with people, and we saw about 50%. Who is more considering their storage at the moment be option three there? Probably not many. No one, really? Option four? Yeah, and something else for everyone else. Don't know what else. Anyone got any, want to tell me? We're back. So I think before we kind of move off this slide, I just want to talk a little bit more about this file server option, right? Because you might be kind of going, like, I don't know, do people get it? They get it? Yep, it's a file server, it's got high performance disk, and you can store your virtual machines on that file server really fast, really high performance. And then why do you want to do that? Really, I think you want to do it because it makes storage really simple. Like, it's a file server. Like, in this room, we know how to manage file servers. We know how to work with data on file servers. We kind of know how to make volumes. It kind of makes sense to us. The only bit that we really need to learn on top of it is that, well, maybe the file server probably has to be clustered. And then how's this, like, shared storage going to work? And how do we kind of carve it up and allocate it out? You know, sometimes some of that work that might be in the realm of the SAN administrators now. So I think I just wanted to show you in... in server 2012, just a really quick example of how simple it is, right? So this server, it's got a connection to some storage. There's four physical disks down here. And at the moment, there's no, you know, we're not doing anything with those disks. And so it's just a simple matter of saying new storage pool, we give it a name. Which disks do we want to be a member of this storage pool? And, you know, do we want any of them allocated to be a hot spare? We create that pool. So, now we've got a pool which happens to be, you know, two disks in this case behind it. And we want to, I guess, carve that up might be a word you'd use, or create virtual disks. And we say, how... on that pool, what do we want? Maybe we'll call this VDisk1. And then the disk itself, what kind of protection do we want on that disk? Do we just want a simple disk? Do we want to mirror it? So we can just say simple in this case. We might just thin provision this disk. We might say that actually, even though we've only got 0.54 of a terabyte, we'll say this disk is 2 terabyte, which will give us nice good flexibility later, and we can just add more disks to it later. If it runs out of space, it won't be a problem. So now we've created that virtual disk, it's 2 terabytes, and do we want to use it in Windows? Yeah, look, we probably do. So we better format it, sign it a drive letter. We might just call it thin D because it's thin provisioned, it's D drive. All right, so there it is, 2 terabytes of disk that's actually being kind of carved off this storage pool that's really, at this point in time, 2 physical disks underneath it. Now, you're probably going, yep, that's cool, thin provisioning, big deal, whatever. Yep, seen it before. Good, you have? You know, VMware's got that. But I find that when you're actually trying to manage that, it gets difficult. You're starting to go, well, hang on, I've got a physical drive here, and then I've got this virtual thing here, and I've got this, like, thin provisioned, and I don't know, this other one that's thick provisioned, and what, like, how much space do I really have, and what's going to happen? So I'll just show you here, if we create another disk on that same storage pool, and in this case, so VDisk 2, in this case, I'll just do simple again, and we'll make it a fixed disk this time. Now, we only have 555 gigabytes of free space. This is actual disk free space right now. So, hey, keep that in mind when you're provisioning. Yeah, thanks very much. I'm going to create it at 545, and it's a fixed disk. So it's actually going to take that whole space right now. So what does that mean? And sorry, I'll just finish this. We'll format that as well, just so that it's available on Windows. All right. So there it is, available. So I've got the 545. Remember, I've only got 555 in total, and I've got this thin 2 terabyte. So really, that's only going to have 10 gig of actual usable space. So that could be a problem, which is why this turned red. like you've over or you're nearing overcommit on that thin provisioned, you're nearing overcommit on the thin provisioned V disks that are on that same storage pool. And so this would feed into Ops Manager and those kinds of things so that you can go and start to proactively action that. And how do we action it? Well, we simply go to that storage pool. We go, hey, I've got some disks in that server that aren't assigned to anything. Why don't I just assign those to the storage pool? And now I don't have a problem. That's pretty cool. Now, maybe I just need to buy some more disks and stick it into that cheap per, SAS storage that this is running from and solve my problem. So think about the kind of flexibility that this provides. And I guess I find like SANs often, they're supposed to be this kind of magical thing that just abstracts the storage from everything else and gives you good flexibility and you just expand it when you want later. I guess start to ask yourself, is that true in your environment? Are you getting those kinds of things out of your SAN? Or are they being a blocker? And are they kind of like, you don't want to touch them and they're always nervous about it. So this provides some new options, I think. Cool. That was the demo. So the last area to think about in the core four main considerations with architecting is resiliency. Okay, what's your approach to resiliency? What happens if hardware fails? What happens? What do you need to happen? And there's kind of two approaches. I hinted at them at the beginning of this session. You can either assume that resiliency is built in to the platform. So the platform will be highly available in almost every component. This is kind of two ends of the spectrum. The platform will provide this completely resilient, high available environment. And so the guest doesn't need to worry about anything. Or maybe the guest actually has resiliency built in. So in which case, my platform doesn't need to provide that. So you need to understand that. You need to think about which one you're providing. Or somewhere in between. Or some kind of mix. Okay. Now, we've spoken about the kinds of things you need to consider. Let's actually just apply some of them to a few scenarios that kind of map out some designs, right? Or architectures. So the three that we're going to go through, the first one's called non-converged enterprise configuration. Okay, non-converged, that means separated networks for the enterprise, right? It's kind of what you have today. Converged data center, so converged networks, or at least some convergence of those networks, with a file server storage, like we just saw that file server. And the last one is, again, a converged network, but with no dedicated, separated storage nodes. So storage in the compute nodes, right? And these scenarios, I didn't make up those names. They came from Microsoft, and they're fully online. They give you step-by-step instructions on how to build out an environment that matches the design of each one of these three scenarios. And there's actually PowerShell scripts as well to automate the build out of each of those scenarios. So that's good. If you like one of these, then you can kind of go and reference more detail about it from Microsoft. So the first one, non-converged enterprise configuration. This is kind of what you're used to today in lots of ways. Five different networks separating each kind of traffic flow out and some shared storage there accessed by all the nodes in the cluster. Cool? You get it? Not a lot of change, really. Quite easy to implement if you've got that kind of networking structure at the moment. You can kind of map it into what you've got. Maybe you don't need five. If you only got four or three today, you can probably still kind of map it to the same network traffic flows. Probably just slot it in and people get it and it's pretty easy. But why would you do it? Well, there's still some features that are available in Server 2012 that will improve the performance of it. So you know, RSS and DCB for the hardware NIC offloading to reduce CPU usage. You can team networks still. You can team all the networks really here. This example was showing maybe teaming on your iSCSI interfaces there. You can use some of the improvements to scale your VMs and make the VMs more resilient. So, you know, teaming on those VM NICs or using VMQ to spread that processing of, I guess, the incoming network, spread the processing across the network, across the CPUs, so that it can decide which VM it needs to go to. So you kind of can keep that base structure but still get some performance improvement just simply by turning on some of the features in 2012 and making sure you've got the right NICs to support that, or using the features that your current NICs do support. And, you know, you can actually decide, well, maybe for just some of your VMs, you actually want to give those VMs straight away just direct raw network access. So you can use SRIOV to give them the direct network access without really changing too much else in your environment. Yep. How does that map? How does that architecture map to the four kinds of storage options we said we had before? Well, really, you know, the first architecture maps to the first storage option where we're scaling the compute nodes separately to the storage. And in this case, you know, it's an existing storage. We've got SAN over fiber channel or iSCSI. Make sense? Second one. This one is converging some of the network a little bit more here. So we're not going completely converged. We're still just separating the tenant network, the VMs network, from all of the data center network. And in this case, we've also made our storage the file server, the Windows 2012 file server. So the compute node, the Hyper-V nodes, are storing the virtual disks for the VMs on the file server and accessing it over the network. Those file servers are clustered and they're using SAS, just a bunch of disks, storage, or they're front-ending a SAN. Cool? Now, what do we get here? Why should we do this? If we're using the file server, it's really, I guess, it can really help us lower our costs. It does this by enabling options for cheaper disks if we want to, but we don't have to. We can still have the SAN behind it. But it's adding this abstraction layer from your storage to the services using that storage. And that abstraction layer is the file server, and we get the file server, and we saw how easily it was just to kind of extend it or change it, add disks to it. And Windows admin, it's all in Windows, and we get it. It's easy. So that can really help drive your support costs down, the cost of making changes to the environment later. You've got this abstraction layer so that if you do go and change out your SAN in the back end, you don't necessarily have to change anything on the Hyper-V host because they're all just accessing the file shares, which all still stay the same. So it can provide a fair bit of flexibility there. There is some other options just to kind of extend to that or change it. If we're thinking about using direct attached storage that's still shared, there's some third-party options around RAID controllers that are designed for this. And then you're not actually using storage spaces in 2012, but instead you're using the RAID controllers themselves to provide that pooling of the disks and parity, etc. But still served out by an SMB3 file share. And I guess just kind of thinking about the other services that you're running on this converged network, we can take advantage of the hardware offloading, the QoS DCB. We can also take advantage of QoS on the switch for the VMs themselves. And I just want to point out actually as well that because there is this two QoS, there's QoS for the hosts and there's QoS for the guests. So just be aware, if you're configuring anything in PowerShell, these are the, you know, they're different commands. So if it's about the host, it's new NetOS, new NetQoS policy. If it's about the switch, the VMs, it's set VM network adapter. And on that host side, if you're wanting to enable DCB, the hardware offloading, there's those other commands there as well to go and extend it. Yeah. So just really be aware of that, the way that QoS is implemented, the way that you set them in PowerShell, quite different. Now, if we wanted to start to, you know, team networks here, because if I just go back a slide there, we see maybe there's just, you know, one network card for those for that data center network. Well, if we want to kind of team them to either get resiliency or more throughput, there's a few things to consider. You can't use RDMA if you team. So if you really, if you've got RDMA enabled hardware, then really the recommendation is not to team. You know, it's a bit of a hard choice here, but it's not all bad, because to, you know, the point of teaming is really to provide some kind of level of resiliency across multiple NICs. If you've got a failure on one, something else can take over, and also to provide better throughput from multiple NICs. So almost all of the workloads or the traffic that you're running over those different kinds of network can be multi-channel. They can actually be configured to use multiple network connections, even though those network connections aren't teamed, right? So you can still say, here's two network connections that you can use for SMB for my storage. Here's two network connections that you can use for live migration. You can give each of those network connections IPs and use them for management. So you don't have to team just to get the advantage of multiple network connections, if you know what I'm saying. So if you don't do that, you can still use the multiple network connections and you can still use things like RDMA. So how does that design fit into our storage options? Number two, surprisingly, is number two. So in this case, we've got our Hyper-V server compute nodes separate to our storage. And the storage happens to be a file server with some disks behind it. Yep. Now, just to kind of set the context here, I want to do a demo, and I want to just kind of show the advantage of using the file server to store it on, right? To store your workloads on. So what I've got is a cluster. I've got a cluster here somewhere. And I've got a machine running on that cluster, a virtual machine. And on this virtual machine, it's stored in a VHD file, right? And that happens to be on this file server. So it's over SMB, file server 01 slash blah, blah, blah. So the SQL Server workload that's running on Hyper-V 03 is stored on the file server. Now, what I'm going to do is move this workload so that it's running on Hyper-V 02. Now, Hyper-V 02 is not in this same cluster as Hyper-V 03 is in. So I'm just moving the workload, SQL 02, onto another host that's not in the same cluster, and there's nothing shared here. Or should I say there's shared nothing? So Hyper-V 02 doesn't really know anything about Hyper-V 03. It's not in the same cluster. They've not got like LUNs carved up and assigned to each other. There's none of that, right? It just came in, it's built, it doesn't know anything about anything. It's just sitting there, it's managed by VMM, and we say, okay, just move this workload from this cluster over to this standalone host, even though it knows nothing about the storage that it's on. When it moves it, it goes, hey, the storage is on this network share, so just use that. And so the data, the virtual hard disk, isn't moving. It's just staying on the file server. But the compute, of that workload is. So kind of a simple concept, but it's pretty significant stuff because we just kind of popped a new server in the environment. We didn't have to do any kind of configuration around like storage assignment. We didn't really particularly need to think about like the hardware in that box. It doesn't need HBAs or anything like that. And we just said, hey, move that workload, and now it's running. Like, pretty flexible. And, okay, it's there. Yeah, actually, that's all I'll show now. So I think that's pretty cool. And this is something that shouldn't be underestimated in your new designs. You really want to be thinking about how you can take advantage of things like that to provide your operational staff much more flexibility in running the environment, right? Okay, the third design, we're nearly at the end, is this converged data center. And in this case, we've actually converged all the networks together, the tenant network and also all the data center traffic flows. And we've gone even further and we've said, let's not use a completely separated storage, a SAN or a scale-out file server. We're not going to use that, but we still want, you know, some resiliency in the storage. And we still want a cluster. So we make a Hyper-V cluster. Each cluster node will be connected up to some shared storage, SAS, let's say. And so in the same way that a scale-out file server would have all been, all the nodes in that cluster would have been connected to some storage and then served out, instead, all the nodes in the Hyper-V cluster are connected to that storage. It's just that it doesn't serve it out as a file system using SMB, it just uses it as a file system. So the nodes in the cluster can all use the storage that's attached to that cluster to store the VHDs for the workloads, right? So you still get to use storage spaces in this kind of scenario, which means you still get that flexibility in the Windows admin of kind of saying, I've got these disks, I want to pull these together as this storage space, I've got these ones, I'll pull them to this, I'll make these virtual disks or VDisks, I'll thin provision those ones, I'll thick provision those, and then on top of those virtual disks, I'll create VMs. And oh, look, it's getting nearly full, not in logical capacity, but in physical capacity, I'll just add some more disks in. You still get that advantage, it just happens not to be running via SMB file share, but instead all the nodes in the cluster are connected to that shared storage. So as well as doing that, we've merged these networks together. And so I suppose, you know, the things to kind of consider there is that we're using QoS and we're using ACLs on those virtual switch to still logically separate those traffic flows and still to provide with QoS the quality of service that each traffic flow demands and needs, and we can prioritise them against each other. I've spoken about that. Now, it's worth noting, actually, I just said that, you know, all the nodes in the cluster, they get access to this shared storage, and they, you know, therefore, you know, it's not over SMB, and you're thinking, cool, each node, wherever a workload happens to be running, that node has a SAS connection to the storage. And it can probably just, you know, read and write directly from that. And the thing is, it's not quite true. Even though they're all connected to that storage, a storage pool is still owned by one node at a point in time. So writes to that storage pool still need to go through the owner node. So you might have two machines, they're in a cluster, they're both connected to the shared storage, and the VMs are running on that shared storage, and one node is running some VMs and one node's running another set of VMs. But the disk writes for this set of VMs still have to happen through the Hyper-V cluster node that owns the owner node of that storage. So it's still over the network, that communication between those nodes, in order to write. So using this option doesn't like change the fact that it's writing storage over the network. even though each node has a direct connection to that disk, the write for that still happens over the network. So because it still happens over the network, you know, we might see that we make a slight change to this network topology of this design to move out that storage traffic flow from the converged network and give it a dedicated network to talk between each cluster node. Yeah. And so, you know, in this case, we'll call that a CSV traffic, the cluster share volume traffic. But think of it really in terms of the SMB traffic, the same kind of traffic you would have if you had nodes storing on a file server. Yeah? Now, that's the three scenarios that we said we'd cover at the beginning, but there is one that's really missing, and I think it should be... Oh, sorry, I should map, firstly, that design maps that storage design, I guess, obviously. Now, this fourth option that isn't covered by the scenarios on the website from Microsoft but is really still applicable here is just the single node Hyper-V server with direct storage only. So it's directly attached and it's non-shared. And, you know, surprise, surprise, that maps to that storage design option. Now, I'll show you in this last demo that workload that we moved before, SQL02, it's running, it's stored on the file server. We moved it from Hyper-V03, the host, in a cluster, to Hyper-V02, the host, not in a cluster. So this host isn't in a cluster, doesn't have anything special, doesn't have any shared storage, it's just got local storage. At the moment, the workload SQL02 is running on it because it's still running from the SMB share. But maybe we're wanting to actually move it so it's local. And all it's a matter of doing is saying move the storage. I think I just actually... Oh, there it is. So this is the storage that I created earlier in this demo. I created that I created that new server, the new storage pool, and I thin provisioned a virtual disk on it called ThinD, and that's what we're going to use to store this virtual machine on. And this here will, without the VM going down, and so it keeps running. The workload keeps running. The storage is being moved from file server 01 onto local disk on this Hyper-V02 node that's got nothing to do with the cluster. So we've just taken, in two steps, without any downtime to that workload, we've taken the workload from a cluster that was using file server storage to a new node that we put in that's not part of a cluster, didn't know anything about this configuration, didn't need any special, you know, storage connections or setup or hardware, just has local disk, and we've moved the workload over to it in one step, and then we've moved the storage of that workload over to it in the second step without the workload going down. Think about the kind of flexibility that that gives you, and think about the cost that it doesn't cost. It's pretty cheap for that kind of thing. And I just want to point out that all of these demos here, like, these are on our labs. We don't have expensive labs. We've got commodity hardware. This is gigabit Ethernet. This is not any of the special NIC offloading stuff. We don't have any of the RDMA. It's not 10 gigabit. It's just cheap, crappy hardware. And it's just really easy and simple to use and really high performance still. All right, so we've spoken about understanding your workloads. This is really important because if you don't know what the workloads are, how are you going to design an infrastructure to run them? We've looked at some of the networking options that you've got. There's lots of new NIC hardware offloading available, but you need to work out which ones you need, what hardware you've got, what works together, what doesn't. You need to think about the fabric underneath, and you need to think about how you're separating the traffic flow. We've looked at some of the storage options, and we've seen how the file server, SMB file server for storing your VMs, just adds this whole layer of flexibility. But of course, it still fully supports all your traditional storage models as well in SAN. And we've spoken about a few resiliency approaches and just really the fact that you need to understand what are you building for. You don't necessarily have to build a completely highly available, fully resilient environment. People come and say, well, I need 5 nines. And then you go, okay, it'll cost this much. Oh, no, actually, I don't need 5 nines, I need 4 nines. Oh, actually, 3 nines. So, you know, I think it's really about understanding what you actually need and then designing to that, right? Obvious stuff, but sometimes people forget it. So, lastly, just to sum up, remember, Server 2012 has been built from the ground up as a cloud-optimized OS. And in this session, we've really just focused on the sections or the features in it that enable really high scale at low cost through both using lower cost hardware and making it simpler and easier to manage and operate and expand and change. And that's how it can really drive the cost down. Okay. We've got a few sessions coming up that, click through these, that are related. I really encourage you to get to this diving into SMB3, which is on at 3:30 today in meeting rooms 5 and 6, right? Now, this session could well win the award this year for worst session title ever because it sounds so boring. But the content will actually be far more exciting than what this content was, actually. It's a really good session. I think if you want to understand why it is, if you're not really believing me in that SMB3 can run your workloads over the network, great, then go to that session and be convinced. And then, you know, this afternoon at 5, I'll be comparing private cloud capabilities. So this one's really been like a nitty-gritty architecture thing. It hasn't been very demo intense. It's really about those kind of architectural considerations. The session this afternoon is much more about that stack above, the management stack, and comparing what Microsoft has to Hyper-V, to VMware. Look, there's a few more there, guys. I think we might be running out of time, so we might have to wrap up, and then I can take any questions after that. Thanks very much.
Trusted friend, we've known each other since we were 9 or 10. Together we've climbed hills.